Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Shattered Innocence. Today's guest is Blackstone Lawyer. We are going to go over Buick's brick mailboxes and the Georgia statutory criminal scheme. Hello, welcome, Blackstone Lawyer. How are you doing today?
Hello. Doing good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. This sounds like an interesting title, especially with a Buick and a brick mailbox.
Well, and especially when it comes to those slicky boy assistant magistrates over there in Cobb County. Man, the story behind those brick mailboxes and his Buick, and then, of course, like you said, the Georgia statutory criminal scheme. I can't recall if we covered it on your program or not, but in 1980, when I was in the eighth grade at Mabry Middle School, I was on a school bus on my way home from school going down Ebenezer Road approaching Knight Road, which was around 250 feet past my driveway, so I would have to ride the school bus kind of like in a circle. To make a ride on down Knight Road over to Blackwell Road and to the intersection of Blackwell and Ebenezer, and it would turn left and it would come back down, and I'd be the last student on the bus to get off of my driveway so the bus driver could go home for the rest of the day. But just past Knight Road on the left, like I said, around 250 feet was actually my driveway. So this ordinary day, I'm in the back seat, bus goes around the curve, and there, Bob Hudson's family there, and the sister of Sheriff Bill Hudson, had a brick mailbox. And I watched these two cars coming around the curve. One was around a 1968-69. Chevelle, remember correctly, it was kind of a green with a black top, and a 1971 Buick Centurion, golden brown, black underneath the lower part of the vehicle, giving it a distinct look than your other Centurions. Painted that color. So it was recognized in 1983 when I met Mike McLaughlin, who had just then started his job at the Cobb County Courthouse for the Magistrate Court, working with pretrial detainees. According to what he told John Ramsey, my brother, and Matt, and the other technicians making graphics when he arrived. Well, he brought this guy who was going by the name of Bill Ramsey, who I just recently discovered to be Frank Delano Floyd, a serial killer. So we get to add Ramsey to this list of aliases. And the other day I was able...
do you know how them two met?
Well, according to them, that night, that evening, after Floyd arrived, we had actually stepped over to Tip Top Poultry. And standing there, we used to be kind of like a parking area there. It's all grown up today. You can't park there anymore. there close to it where people would pull off and park their vehicles and go to other places, or some people would park their vehicles who worked at the plant itself. But that's actually where Mike McLaughlin pulled his car into when he arrived with Floyd to drop him off to go with us, of course, down to South Cobb Drive below Windy Hill Road where we met Mel Mondingraft, and then, of course, to this bar that was over at the Powers Ferry interchange there at 285. And, of course, that's the bar I had to escape. It was really the first time I was ever been held captive anywhere, especially in a bar. That's where we wound up. But he was living in Dayton, Ohio, renting an apartment up there. And if I remember correctly, he found him a 16-year-old female he was trying to abduct. And John Ramsey was staying at a motel nearby. And he had left this motel, and just by chance, came in this parking lot. I think it was shopping center or something like that. I can't remember exactly where they said they, you know, it occurred at. But John sat there and was witnessing Floyd trying to abduct the 16-year-old female. And he wasn't doing a very good job at it. She was giving him a good fight, was about to get away. So John starts his car. He gets out and starts running over to come to aid Floyd. Floyd doesn't know that. He thinks he's coming to aid the girl. So,
wow.
Of course, he pulls out his knife, and he's about to cut John. And John is like, what are you doing? I come to help you, buddy. You know? And just that one mistake. And they were able to abduct a woman and take her off and actually do their thing and kill her. And that's how John Ramsey and Frank Floyd became partners and buddies.
And they spilled
and
the beans and told
the,
you all this, huh?
Yeah, it's assuming that they weren't going to get rid of me that night, so they were just going to sit there and just kind of give me an idea of just what kind of lunatics I was actually meeting with.
It's funny how people, when they go to, they shouldn't have killed, they go ahead and start professing their, a lot of their things that they've been doing and stuff like that. So they're just like, I'm not going to worry about it. You can be dead anyway. You ain't going to be able to tell.
Yeah, you're not going to be able to say to anybody anything to anybody because we're getting rid of you anyway. I mean, as many times as I've heard that now out of different ones, it's funny. Because just, people know it wasn't a simple walk hard. I'd be lying to say, well, yeah, I just went out and stopped all this stuff, no problem. Well, no. I wish I could say that, but there was a lot of problems stopping this mess, and there was a lot of attempts on my life, and there was a lot of them severely injured. Many were put in ICU and hospitals, broken jaws and cheeks. Had my picture over there in the White County Jail for 10 years on the wall, people thinking I was working undercover with the White County Sheriff's Department because I had one decide to jump me in one establishment over in Helen one night, one evening, and right after the Sheriff's Department the hospital in Cleveland, they got a call where three more of them decided to jump in another establishment, and they had to provide the escort this woman to take her husband to the emergency room. And that's how that my picture wound up over in the White County Jail on the wall until they tore down the old jail. So it was no easy walk in the park with these people. I've had so many attempts on my life. It's ridiculous. Three before on my 18th birthday. I mean, and they were just getting warmed up then. But it's funny what they'll tell you when they think they're going to kill you because they don't think you can tell anybody else.
You were 17 when they first ran into that bunch?
No, I actually, Jim Stubbs, believe it or not, the one who attempted to execute me, assassinate me, however you want to put it, up in Morganton, Georgia, back in 1975, was actually Ed Bentley Jr.'s brother-in-law.
Wow, okay, that's how that ties in. I remember you telling me, but I'm just giving the listeners a call, you know, an idea.
Yeah, it ties into Bentley Enterprises, Access Graphics, Layton Graphics, of course, Home Depot, Dunkin' Oil. It's like Jim Jordan and James Comer when they announced back in December of 2021 about Hunter Biden that there was two individuals that had put out information about Hunter Biden on social media. And there was only two people that had the audacity to even make any type of posts about Hunter Biden. But they found out that the posts were accurate and true. So we're not finished yet. I mean, we're not. We are getting, we about got it wrapped up now where everybody could go to the internet and pull this stuff up and just kind of check out, about who's really, really involved, who acted under duress and the amount of victims that they have created out of all this. And a lot of their families of these victims are about to get closure for the homicides, and the whole world's going to be taking them. I wouldn't say a totally different view of Wayne Williams, but Wayne, he just can't get out of being at least a procurer in the Atlanta child murders. Not actually responsible directly for the murders themselves, but being a procurer for the child sex trafficking network, who is responsible for the Atlanta child murders. And we can call it a number of names. We can call it John Ramsey, LLC. We can call it Arthur Blank, LLC. We can call it the Jewish Aryan Republican Army. I mean, if we really want to get down to the gist of it, the amount of Jewish guys that was actually involved with John Ramsey, my brother, and Ed Bentley, and Ed Jr., and my cousin Robert Veach in this bunch, you'll get a real good idea about how many CEOs of corporations were actually involved in this.
Somebody I was speaking to last night, they were astounded, and we were talking, they were telling me it's unreal when we get sent to tell police officers and everything to go to a police officer, find a police officer if they're having a trouble. But then to kind of find out, a lot of the police officers are in with this too. I'm not saying all police officers are bad. It just gives us a reason to ask, who do we really trust? Which one's going to be the good ones? Which one are going to really do their job and protect us?
Well, as they say, you know, a lot of times, you know, the good die young, and You know, some of them say the only good cop is a dead cop, which you and I both have to disagree. I've known a lot of good men and women who worked in law enforcement who just really believed that they were, you know, doing justice for their community and working in law enforcement. But
exactly.
we're starting to find out that these people involved in this, they're, you know, all walks of life. Some of them will be police officers, some of them be prosecutors, judges, legislators, and it's nothing new. There's a percentage of the American people who really already knows this. They've already been doing their research well before the COVID-19 lockdown, we call it. And the lockdown, it kind of really backfired because it gave people nothing to do but get on the internet and start going in and start, you know, researching what they call conspiracy theories. Others, they were out there doing the mathematics of what the news was providing us as far as the statistics, and just came up with the mathematics and the equation that there was less than 3% fatality rate in the COVID-19, you know, deaths, which was less than the common flu, with the exception to New York and Los Angeles. There, those cities were at 6%. And the reason for that was they three major factors that they had to know would kill people, and that was one, taking the hydroxychloroquine off the shelves, two, putting people on ventilators. Anybody that's ever had pneumonia, including myself, multiple times will tell you, do not put somebody that's got pneumonia on a ventilator, especially if it's where they seem like they really need one, is when they really do not need one. What they need is a high amount of humidity, okay, in the room. Moisture to kind of moisten the air for them to where they can be able to breathe in and take all the particles out of the air. Now, I've never tried the HEPA during that. I've tried a low mist humidifier systems before, but every time that I ever had double pneumonia, or especially when I had double pneumonia, even pleurisy, I always used a humidifier. But they were killing people. They were giving them Advil, which was causing the virus to become more deadly in the patient, because you know what COVID-19 really is actually the Kawasaki disease.
Kawasaki?
Mm-hmm. That is actually pretty much, I figured out, is really what COVID-19 is. Now, there's a story that ties into this, believe it or not, and the Kawasaki disease. When I say ties into this, the domestic terrorism. In 1989, at the Nautilus Fitness Center on the corner of Windy Hill Road and Powers Ferry Road, there's this huge shopping plaza, kind of like mall, right there on the corner. And in the very top, Back then it had a bar and the Nautilus Fitness Center. And the place would close up, I think, around 11 o'clock at night. It had a nursery where people could leave their children to play in while they went and exercised. So they pulled up the cart, closed up the 11 o'clock one night, cleaned up the carpet. I think they finished around like maybe 3:30, maybe 4 o'clock in the morning. So the carpets didn't have time to dry. They opened up like at 6. So these customers came in to exercise and put their children in the daycare there. And I think out of the 15 children that was in there, 11 of them came down sick with something. 8 of them were hospitalized. And 5 of them wound up dying, passing away from this disease.
Wow.
And what it is carpets, if you don't know how to keep them deep cleaned and shampooed and maintained and all that, they were actually designed to hide the dirt back when they were invented. That's what carpet was for, was to hide the dirt. That's the reason why people bought it and put it down, because they were sick and tired of having to sweep all the time. So it was a good concealer of the dirt. Well, since people wanted to be able to keep it clean and fluffy and maintained, well, of course, you had your companies that popped up that the extraction was the original way that they said, well, if you're going to clean it, you're going to have to wash it. And that's where we got into the truck-mounted type machines. They call it steam cleaning. It's really not actually steam. It's just a bit of hot water, and it's chemicals and agents. Well, with that buildup in there, you got all kinds of bacteria, just about any type of virus in your carpet, anything from HIV to herpes, all of that will be in your carpet. And
yeah,
that's sure. Yeah. And if you're going to have in order, you know, to keep it out, you have to keep that carpet clean. So when people was coming in that gym and working out and the children in the daycare playing, you know, you had the stuff off the shoes, the skin off the bodies. So when they come in and they wetted it, all that bacteria just went crazy. All these viruses that laid in there that was dormant, they just go wild. It doesn't matter how strong of a disinfectant or deodorizer that you're using, you are not going to kill off all that bacteria. You're going to make it go wild. It goes crazy. So here was the carpet still wet when the children came into the daycare that morning. And this is why I expressed to people, well, if you're going to clean your mattresses, just make certain that when you go buy a vacuum cleaner that is capable of cleaning, deep cleaning your mattresses, because if it's not capable of really deep cleaning your mattress, it's really not going to be really much use on an area rug nor a carpet. So always make certain when you get one, it's going to work on your mattress and keep that, you know, dead skin and stuff that builds up in there no time out of your mattress. You want one that's, and you're probably going to have to spend the money to get a good, decent one. But they're worth the money because when you have that crap out of your mattress, when you lay down and it's out of your pillows, your body gets a much easier rest when you're not having to breathe that mess when you're asleep at night. So it's easier on your body when you lay down to sleep, so you get a much, much better sleep when you're sleeping in a clean bed. And the pillows, I've had people tell me, well, I'll throw them in the washer and then the dryer. No, you dry them, you throw them in the dryer first. You want to shake that mess out of there before you actually wash it. You want to get it out while it's dry. And it's really the same thing in carpets. You really want to get that mess out while it's dry, because once you wet it, it comes a mushy mess. And you're going to play hell getting it out once it's wet. So I always recommend waiting 24 hours after a carpet or upholstery is dry to even use it for, you know, allow your pets or children to lay on it or use it. Because when you clean, when this stuff gets clean, yeah, it'll dry. You can sit on it while it's dry, but the bacteria and stuff hasn't died down yet. It doesn't matter if they use a disinfectant and all that on it. It still is going to have live bacteria. So you wait 24 hours after it's dry before, you know, allowing your children to walk in it and play in it or sit on it or whatever. And if you do clean your mattress, you always want to wait 24 hours after it's dry before you sleep on it. So there was this large lawsuit against the Nautilus Fitness Center. So they wound up going bankrupt. So they had to turn around, and I think they became American Fitness, if I remember correctly. And they were in business for decades till they wound up getting sued again. Then they turned around and became LA Fitness. And so it's LA Fitness today, what was originally not the Nautilus Fitness Center. Well, anybody that knows this case and knows, I'm familiar with my knowledge of John Ramsey, I'll know that, you know, I've been a member of LA Fitness and actually know which LA Fitness is partner, who they call Dale Montegraff, which isn't his real name. He don't like to tell anybody his real name, because he was a executive really with Kodak before he switched over to Polaroid.
Yeah, I was thinking that's who you was telling me about. That's, you know, because you said that whenever, like, there was these real films and stuff like that, and again, even then developed, they needed somebody like them to develop it, the films.
Well, yeah, the pictures that when he was with Kodak, he used to work the little booths there, the little buildings in these shopping centers in Marietta, Smyrna, and Decatur, and Atlanta, all over. They had the little Kodak drive-up booths where the people could drop off their proofs and come back later and pick up their pictures. And, you know, families would take pictures of their little naked babies, you know, as pictures for the family to see them, you know, their birthday suits, you know, nothing sexual about it. Well, these perverts was turning around and selling them over in Europe to perverts over there who were looking at them, you know, in a perverted way. I mean, but whenever it came down to the U.S. government going to shut down the mica production in the U.S. in 1984, that everything went over to microfilm. Well, there was only two companies really in the film business in the U.S., and that was Kodak and Polaroid. And Polaroid just so happened to have a better quality, clear film than what Kodak came up with, And that's when Monty abandoned ship with Kodak, went over to Polaroid, got with John Ramsey, and they're the ones who created the computer software for the microfilm data entry that replaced the microchip industry after the U.S. government shut down the mica production. That's why all the microchip production left the United States and, of course, wound up over there in Japan and Indonesia.
One thing I hated was when I tried to get records at my old OBGYN, years after I stopped going there, they said, well, it's all on microfiche now, and they said there's no way for them to make a copy. I said, how's that? How come? But I was never able to obtain a copy because they said they didn't have nothing to be able to, you know, print that out, you know, what's on microfiche. And I thought, well, why'd y'all put it on that if you're, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I ran into that hurdle. That's when I was trying to go and look for proof behind some of the stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, what Georgia has done, this is what people don't realize, is it's actually defined its system of law, is pretty much what it did after the millennium, because the courts operate under the guise of legitimacy. They have defined their system of law as the Georgia statutory criminal scheme. So this is how much that they're doing it in the faces of the American people without the American people really recognizing it, because it's really stuff that lawyers and, you know, are supposed to know. But the knowledge is out there because of even the prisoners and inmates know that Georgia is operating under a statutory criminal scheme.
I think that's kind of funny. That's a good name for it, statutory criminal scheme. That's right, criminal.
and that's exactly what it is. And everybody wonders, well, why did they not ever prosecute John Ramsey? Well, they now get to find out that people like Cobb Assistant Magistrate Mike McLaughlin was in the Ramsey home participating in the homicide of JonBenet when she was murdered. The same thing with her water skiing instructor over there in Hiawassee, Georgia, in the summer of 1996, when her parents was staying with Big Ray Duncan in his house over there, and another family was using their house on Lake Chattooga, so they shared Big Ray Duncan's home with him. And Eric Rudolph was her water skiing instructor. And he was in the Ramsey home when JonBenet was murdered. The anonymous caller to the Centennial Park attack, Joey Davis, he was there and involved in the homicide of JonBenet. Oklahoma City and Centennial Park bomber, Mike Cook, was there. His brother, Jeff Cook, was there. Now, I don't know if Fred was there, but... Ma'am?
And you said Epstein and Ghislaine were
yes,
there?
Yes, Jeff Epstein was there. Ron Brill was there. A lot of John's partners in the Atlanta child murders and the West Memphis 3 and Oklahoma City bombing were actually there when JonBenet was murdered. Now, there was some gas that was in that house during that party who were clueless on what was and what did occur until after it occurred. They just knew that when they was at the party, there was this little rope that was being passed around. They didn't know for what, but it was just being passed around for everybody at the party to handle as they passed it around. Because, see, JonBenet was not murdered overnight in her home, like John Ramsey and the police and Boulder and all them say. JonBenet was actually, her torture, if I remember correctly, started around 7:30 Christmas evening. And there were guests in the house. There was parties going there and next door at Fleet White's house. So all the false narrative about John Ramsey pulled coming home from the party, and JonBenet being in sleep in the back of the vehicle, why heck? She must have been doped up for her to fall asleep from the Whites in the vehicle just to drive home next door. I mean, this stuff is ludicrous. Yeah. Now, it's unclear if they went to another place before coming back to their home during the party. But it was at 9 o'clock if they did go to another party outside of theirs and the Fleet's home. JonBenet was dead by 9 o'clock. They took her body, and I was told there was this little small ruined space that he could put under the house that would preserve her body until the next morning, until he could clean her up and stage the scene. Because that's one thing, is one of John's trademarks.
Is that one of the things he told you about, you know, when, before he was going to kill you?
Yeah, in his January 2023 interview, he sat there and he describes the telephone call that he got about Beth Ramsey, his oldest daughter, and he was told that that she was in the condition that there was nothing that the doctors could no longer do for her. And, well, in order to get her back, he had, you know, focus on JonBenet, okay? Well, number one, your daughter is dead. How are you going to get your daughter back? You're not going to get her back as far as coming back to life, that's for certain.
Right.
Okay, so there's only one way to get her back, okay, now that she's dead, and that is go through with a murder of JonBenet, like he told her he would do in 1991.
He told Beth Ramsey what I was going to do. What was his words again?
The moment he got home, he was going to sexually assault her. And he was going to dye her hair blonde, put her in these beauty pages to dress her up like a little beauty queen, because that was Beth's biggest fear, was JonBenet, you know, being in these beauty pages because Patsy, you know, was a beauty queen, and they used to try to get Beth to get in these beauty pageants. And Beth, she didn't want to go in these beauty pageants, even at the age that she was. She had some knowledge about beauty pageants that I didn't have. Now, Matt, her boyfriend, he gave me a pretty good rundown about some things that she was ashamed to tell me about that had happened to her during her childhood. Because she was very, very much a very high moral woman, once she got with him, they wanted the most and the best out of life they could have. But on the other hand, here was her dad, Ed Bentley, Judge McLaughlin, all these bigwig elite in Atlanta, just some of the most filthiest rich scum in the world is the only way that they could put it. That these people were so degraded that it was beyond their imagination that we would have a government being run by these people. So they were not going to just sit back and allow her dad, just, you know, have this beautiful little, you know, baby girl named JonBenet wind up doing to her what he did to Beth that started when she was 7 years of age. So their whole mission and goal was to get them busted for child sex trafficking and all these murders that they had committed and get him sent off and Patsy in a nut ward to where they could raise Bert and JonBenet themselves. That is what got Beth and Matt murdered. And, of course, her friend Paula from grammar school for being dragged into it. Now, John, he couldn't figure out what to do about me because he really couldn't blame me in a way in as much as he could his own daughter and her boyfriend because they would not get married as long as her dad was not in prison. They wanted to get married and have children and have a normal life, but they couldn't do it once he had JonBenet. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. Once Beth got to sit down and hold JonBenet for the first time, she said her heart just melted over that little baby girl. She just fell in love and wanted the best for her little half sister.
Right.
And they could not function in this world just knowing what they had in mind to do to this country in 1995. They were about to start then. They knew all about it. And they come to find out that I had accused Francis Cook's oldest son, Mike Cook, of going to blow up the federal building that was intended to be blown up in 1995. I had accused him of going to blow it up at a baseball game in 1974. And even him and her couldn't believe that. But that is why they're dead. And, of course, they did come after me because I told them to where they could put their $4.5 million of hush money, that it wasn't just blood money, that it was child blood money, and they could stick all that some blood money up where, you know, where. I was moving out of Marietta. I would go out here and work to make my living. I wasn't going to say a word unless I ran across another one of their child trafficking operations. And they better hope to God I don't run across another one of them, because then I would get out and I would expose them. And sure enough, when I married my first wife, I wound up living in the county north of another one of their child trafficking operations there in Andalusia, Alabama. Now,
hold on a minute. I want to go ahead and tell callers They can call in to ask questions or talk to him at 563-999-3517. Again, the number to call is 563-999-3517. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So after they attempted to abduct me some more down there in Evergreen, and, of course, my brother Fred and some of them wound up being ran off the road, chasing me, and I played chicken with them. I was leaving Evergreen, Alabama one day. I had a 1983 Pontiac Grand Prix, SJ, white with T-tops, red interior, Sony cassette player with a Clarion equalizer like I had in my 77 Grand Prix I got 1983, the night that I met John Ramsey. And, of course, Mike McLaughlin and them. Well, I'm coming down Brooklyn Road, and I get there just before County Road 36. Between two houses is sitting that 1971 Buick Centurion. I didn't notice it when I passed by, except I just saw it parked there. Didn't pay much mind to it until it pulled out behind me. And it come rushing up on my bumper the way it did. I looked at it, and I recognized it, and I'm like, holy cow. It was Judge Mike McLaughlin. So, of course, my bump, mill gun, my little old 305, you know, against that big old 455 four barrel, and we church there. They had also burnt when they found out that I lived down in that area because it was a black church. A friend of mine, Fred Salter, was actually the custodian of that church, and he also was the custodian of the courthouse there in Evergreen, Alabama, the Conecuh County Courthouse. But they wound up burning that church, too. But, of course, it was remodeled and, you know, the burn damage was repaired and it's still there. But, yeah, I put my little Jim Rockford stunt on him, spun back and spun my car around, which, of course, he was good at that, too. The dude really knew how to handle that automobile. He was really good with him. Of course, I was really good with mine. But it just didn't have the ass behind it that 455 had. So I had to pull that stunt again because I knew if I could get down to the community of Paul down there at Brooklyn Paul Road and get him behind me there, I could cause him to crash into the brick mailbox of Grady Rawls, owner of Grady Rawls Construction, the largest road construction company who contracts for the state of Alabama that does the road work there for on its highways. Him and his wife, Willardine, they had built a brick mailbox there a year before because of the rednecks coming down there with their ball bats and axe handles and clubs and stuff and knocking mailboxes off the post every so often. Then Grady's sister and brother-in-law, C.R. Carol Pate, also worked there at Rawls Construction. They had their mailbox built out of iron and had it look kind of like a country house, kind of built out of wood, painted up like it was built out of wood, because they wanted one of them rednecks to hit their ball bat against that iron mailbox to where they could hear the yip. Yeah, you, from the spring in the fingers, you know, you hit one of them iron mailboxes, your fingers are like sprung in the joints for a minute. It's like hurts.
Oh, like yeah.
Like crazy. So that's the reason why they built the mailboxes the way they did there. And Grady and Willa Dean, they built theirs out of brick. It was a beautiful white, you know, brick mailbox. It was right there at the road where the postman could pull right up, put the mail in, and go right on. And that road is kind of windy and tricky there when you come off of Brooklyn Road and onto Brooklyn Paul Road. You got all that gravel that gathers up there in the turnoff there from all the log trucks dropping gravel and all that while going up and down the road. Because Pates, they're big loggers down there in that area over there in the community of Brooklyn. They like to, you know, they and the McLeans, they just pretty much control the logging down there for Georgia Pacific. So, I made that turn. He bumped me a couple of times in the back to see if I would, you know, freak out and maybe run off the road or something. No, I knew how to handle my automobile well. It just didn't have the speed that his did. And fortunately, we buy a log truck, and then, of course, we passed by some other cars, so he couldn't get up beside me and point his 357 at me again, because what he had was a big old 357 Magnum. It could have been a 40x5, but it looked more like a 357. But I had practiced making that turn a bunch of times in case I would have to do this in a chase. So I missed the gravel. He didn't. That car went over into the ditch there as he went in. His front tires hit that, and he just went over, and there's this little itty-bitty bank there with some trees, some little trees, I'd say about, you know, maybe five inches in diameter, maybe 6 inches in diameter. And, of course, that messed up his passenger side fender, so he wasn't too happy about that, that when he gunned it, it kind of shot over to the opposite side of the road. Because he gunned his car too hard. And so he had to spin it back out. Of course, I had pedal to the metal. I'm gunning my car as fast as that puppy will go down that road. So when he did get on my bumper, it would be just before the drop there before the Morales' driveway and brick mailbox, because the road just turns immediately after... it just turns immediately after you pass their driveway. So if you're right up on someone's bumper, you're not going to see what's in front of them. You have to be about three car lengths back to be able to even get an idea. You're still not going to see what's in front of that car until it drops down. And anyway, just hold on just a second.
Okay.
Okay, I'm back. Yeah, he knows I'm on this conversation. So anyway, so I just had my car directed to that brick mailbox, and at the last minute, I cut my wheels to the left. Barely to miss that mailbox myself, and there he was looking at it dead center. And that big old Buick, just when he cut it to the left, it was impossible to miss it. He skinned it with a right front fender, and when that happened, it just pulled the car into the mailbox and just threw him over. Lucky for him, his head hit the vent window of the passenger door instead of hitting the brick mailbox. If not, it would have killed him instantly. But fortunately, or unfortunately, his head hit the vent window. And, of course, this guy, I'm not going to mention his name. He's passing by in his, you know, Chevrolet four-wheel drive. He slows down when he sees me stop. I'm motioning him. I said, oh, you got a wreck up the road here. Rawls's brick mailbox. Oh, really? So I'm backing up as he's riding by. I'm backing my car back up. Willardeen, she's coming out in her bathrobe and got her half shoes on. She wasn't at the office. So she's walking out there and check on him, hoping he ain't dead. I get out. He's laying down, so I'm like, well, maybe he's dead. So I go and look at the damage on the passenger side of the car. Yeah, it was destroyed. And he gets up, and I'm like, oh, no. And he gets up. He's got the gun in his right hand. It's dangling by his right arm. And he looks at me, and he goes, best get out of here before I shoot you and her both. So I pretended like I didn't even know Willardine. I just looked at her, and I was like, ma'am, I'm sorry. We're just a couple buddies that was racing. He didn't mean to hit your brick mailbox, but he's got insurance. And if there's any damage, I know he'll make it right. You know, he's a judge up there in our county, so he's good to go. I'm sorry, ma'am, about him hitting your brick mailbox. You have a wonderful day, you know. Like I didn't know.
Right.
And everybody was talking about that after that. And I said, is there anything I can do for you, Mike? He goes, yeah, stop down there at the box truck and tell Larry and them that I'm up here. I said, we'll do it, Mike. So I get in my car and I drive down. I'm trying to think of the name of the intersection there by Paul Grocery. And sure enough, there's one of those old black UPS trucks sitting there on the oncoming lane on the side of the road. And there was another time I had to cut down through the yard there, this one house. There was another truck was parked in the same place. They were trying to chase me, and I cut down in the yard to go around him instead of trying to confront him on the road. But there was one sitting there, though. The Jacoby brothers are going by the Roan brothers, Larry Roan, I forgot, Danny Roan or whatever alias they like to use as the Roan brothers, because Floyd, he was Bill Ramsey, and some people mistook Jacoby or the Roans as Bill Ramsey. You know, that's Frank Floyd.
Uh-huh.
So, anyway, he got transported from the hospital from Evergreen to Columbus, where they had the better doctors. And everybody at the courthouse in Marietta wondered why he sold his favorite automobile, that Buick, while he was on vacation in Alabama, because he told everybody he was taking him a vacation to Alabama. And he always liked to drive his Buick. They said he loved driving that car more than he did his Mercedes. Well, yeah, he was anytime he needed to get rid of somebody, he would have that automobile. So it wouldn't be unusual for him to have that automobile if he was having to run down the road and assassin someone. So, of course, that was his favorite automobile as far as the people at the courthouse were concerned. So they just thought, well, he took a two-week vacation, but why in the world did he sell his car? Nobody knew until 2005. And this was when we started the rallies there in Marietta Square, petitioning the state of Georgia for the death penalty for child rape, and the adoption of Megan's Law, the Coalition for Children. We wanted to use JonBenet as one of our mascots, which I knew the Ramseys were not going to allow to happen. This would be my way of kind of getting some exposure on them.
Uh-huh.
So I took John, because John, I didn't kill John, for stalking my mom at the executor back in May of, 2000. Instead of killing him, made him an ally and a buddy. And if you can ever defeat your enemy, love is the best way to defeat them. Is show them love, believe it or not. Because that's what I did with John. And John has helped me get over 215 children rescued from sex trafficking. All because of what happened in 2005 when this came out in Marietta. Because he was like a lot of people who had thought in 96 that I just jumped up there and wanted to gain brownie points for the government. I wanted to get money before I could be a law enforcement officer and I could arrest people and flump around like my ego. This is the type of personality that my brother and them would like to put out about me, about, having this, as he would put it, badass mentality. And I had this real big ego and would fight at a drop of the hat when everybody who knew me knew I didn't start fights. They always knew I finished them, not start them. Well, he would tell people, well, the other guy started because he smarted off to them, or he did this, or he did that. He would always provoke the fight, and the fight was, lie after lie after lie. I mean, I had to reinvent myself in 1992, 1993, when I realized that the habits of lying that I had picked up from my older brother was my number one problem, that I no longer really had to lie about a doggone thing. And actually, you talking about, it's kind of like I felt like I set myself free. I was no longer under a bondage of myself that I had kept myself under for being a liar. And it took me a little while to do it, to transition away from that, but I would just sit there and screw it. I was not telling anyone. Someone asked me about something that happened. Nah, I was going to tell them how it happened. I was no longer going to sugarcoat it, juice it up, cover for somebody. Nope. I put the end of that in 93. It no longer happened. But even though I've been accused of making up stuff about other people, just let the people view the evidence. That way they can decide for themselves. With an open mind, they can draw their own conclusion. And I'm very well confident that everybody's going to realize Charles Rogers is telling the truth, and I am not holding back anything, and I am not trying to juice this up to make it appear worse than what it is, because I don't have to, because that's how bad it really is.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. But Georgia has actually defined its operation of its legal system as the statutory criminal scheme. So the same people, this is all sums it up, is who did Eric Robert Rudolph work for? Well, he was working for Zell Miller as a handyman over there at the Brasstown Valley Golf Club in Young Harris, Georgia, before and after he was wanted by the FBI. Zell and Shirley Carver, and Shirley being the president of the Federal Reserve Bank branch in Atlanta, did a 100-year lease on that land with the state of Georgia. And of course, being governor, you can do pretty much anything you want. Do a doggone cheese ball deal with the state of Georgia, build a doggone resort and a golf club. Well, that's what they did, built a resort for that golf club. And sold it eventually. But they built this say they built the first one. It was okay. But the one that they really built was further back. You can't see it from the road like you could the first one. So they started the construction on it in 1997. I'm thinking around, I don't know, maybe May or June. I don't remember exactly when they started it. But they completed it just before spring of 1998. So Eric, he had done this rough texture for a lot of motel chains like Laquita and some others. You get this rough texture, smooth on these walls of these motels. There's a good chance that Eric Rudolph was the one that textured the sheetrock in those motels, because that's what he was doing to the resort at the Brasstown Valley Golf Club until they completed the construction of that resort around April of 1998. So he was still working on it even after the feds were out in the woods of Western North Carolina searching for him. He was in there at night doing the work, not in the day. He was doing the work overnight. So there wasn't Eric camping out anywhere in Western North Carolina whatsoever. He did go over there after 1998 and was up there camping up there behind O'Grady's house over there in Hanging Dog for a while. That's because everybody else at that time were hands off of him. Some of them had gone over there to the bridge looking for him and wanted to kill him anyway. So he couldn't stay at the bridge all the time. But he was able to stay there some and still maintain going and getting food out of his assigned dumpster that was there behind the old Piggly Wiggly. It was Piggly Wiggly when he was assigned it, but it got bought out by Save-A-Lot.
Okay.
My buddies. Yep. So he could not eat out of any dumpsters but that one dumpster. He had to have plenty of oats that he could eat. That was the only thing that he was to be supplied by anyone was oats, because an oatmeal up there. And that was to absorb the blood of these children that he had drank, was the purpose of those oats. And so I didn't even have the Macon County law enforcement go in there and clean out and raid his hydroponic lab. The boys that had killed Frank Sheldon and Strassmeyer and Holloway in my defense there around September 23rd, 1999, I just told them to go over there and operate it. They earned it. I knew growing marijuana was illegal. But I told them to go ahead and just maintain that in operation. And, you know, once a year, just go over there, that bridge, and drop him off just a little small piece of a bud and a rolling paper and some matches that he could actually light the thing with. That way he would know exactly what he lost for being a deep state child raping, murdering domestic terrorist. Because he grew really good stuff, both indoor and outdoor. And when the feds were overlooking for him, a lot of times he was hiding out there in his hydroponic lab, there close to his house in Topton. So that's why the RICO evidence has been turned over to the magistrate of Macon County to get the indictments on the rest of the partners of Eric Rudolph and John Ramsey and indicted. My older brother, Fred, he passed away, I think, on the 19th of May in 2021. So I don't have to worry about him come lurking around and telling people, why don't you get in touch with my little brother I got a message for him. It's an important family matter, and I need to find out where he is and all that. I don't have to worry about that anymore. I can actually safely go out here places and don't have to worry about him come lurking around with Roger Nance or John Andrew Ramsey or John Ramsey or any of those doggone deep state sissies. And I doubt that John Andrew is going to find anybody else that's going to want to try to help him do anything to me, especially what happened over there in the bar called The Place in Marietta. If I remember correctly, it was back in 2006. It was after we got the death penalty passed for child rape in Georgia and got the Megan's Law adopted. I think it was just shortly after that happened, I was coming back from Atlanta cleaning upholstery for one of the rent-to-own stores one night, and I noticed a group of cars follow me off the interstate who went and passed me like the other vehicles. So something, it just didn't seem at the moment. I just had a funny feeling. I just kind of watched them. So when I turned off the Highway 5 connector on the Sandy Plains Road, they all turned. So I went across the railroad tracks up by the Chevron station and decided to make a left there back into that neighborhood just to see if they would turn off and follow me in through that neighborhood back onto the old Canton Road. So they did. They turned off when I turned, and I went down, I turned, came back up Canton Road. They all turned and came up behind me, and I said, well, okay, I'm going over here to The Place. That's where a lot of my buddies that grew up with hang out at. The majority of the bartenders knew for years, even back when it was Surrey's, back before I even moved away from Marietta. So it was kind of like my favorite spot back when my younger single days. So I knew a lot of people that went in there. So they decided to follow me in there, and they took different spots and positions in The Place. He sat down over close to where I was at the bar when I was talking to some of the bartenders and people that hadn't seen me in a while and just sitting there chatting with them. And he just sat there at a table and just stared at me. I think a waitress came by and asked him for something. I don't know if he ordered a drink or not, but she was making her rounds. And he just sat there and he wouldn't take his eyes off of me. And I couldn't really place who he was. I kind of had a feeling that he was John Andrew Ramsey, but I just wasn't 100% certain.
He had that pursed lip too, right?
Yeah, he pulls his lip in. Looks like he has a hair lip, the way he pulls that lip in and the way he talks.
Uh-huh.
And believe me, he almost got a hair lip that night. He doesn't have one, but he almost got one when he made the mistake of him and his five buddies coming in that bar that night after me. That was a bad mistake. So I went over, sat down in front of him, asked him if he stared at people everywhere he went. And of course, he said he didn't. They just only stared at me. And, of course, I won't know why he was just sitting there staring at me. He just sat there and told me he was amazed. And, of course, I had to ask him what he was so amazed about and what was so amusing about me. They didn't want to sit there and stare, and he wouldn't say anything. And so I asked him, I said, well, what are you, a homosexual? He was, no, I ain't a homosexual. And I said, well, if you're not a homosexual, then why in the hell are you sitting over here staring at me? And he goes, well, you really don't want to know. I said, yeah, I do. I said, there's one way to find out who you are. Is one, you just do it the easy way and tell me who you are. Or two, I'm going to beat it out of you. So which one's it going to be? Are you going to voluntarily tell me your name? Or am I going to have to kick your ass to get it?
Uh-huh.
And he goes, well, I'll just give... He goes, you're not going to kick my ass to get it, but... Do you remember Beth Ramsey? I'm like, yeah, I remember Beth. And he goes, well, I'm her brother, John Andrew. That's when I lost it. He jumped up and he went running out that bar. His buddies thought they were about to come over and grab me, and some of my buddies over there was like, Charles, who in the hell are these people? And what's going on? And some of the others that were over behind me, couple of them, my one in the back, I went back toward him, and he kind of scooted up to the front, and that's when I had to tell everybody my name, my title, Charles Rogers. I told him Private Agent Charles Rogers, the appointed provisional governor of the state of North Carolina, and these were the people responsible for JonBenet Ramsey's murder. Those boys, they were mad. One of them thought he was going to come over and punch me or something. His buddy grabbed him and pushed him back against the wall there by the restrooms. And he goes, buddy, we're outnumbered. He will kill you. And he's like, do what? I said, no, he don't believe you, man. By all means, let him loose. I said, he don't believe you. I'll make a firm believer out of him. And because that was after I had my ordeal over at the Papa Doe's there on Windy Hill Road with Jeff Carrier and Tom Payne, because I knocked Tom Payne out and put him in the ICU at Cobb General for 4 days. And so, and that was in 2005. I ran across Jeff. Jeff tried to kill me 4 times when my daddy was dying in the ICU at Piedmont Hospital in July 2001. And I stumbled across him there at Papa Doe's, I think.
What state is Piedmont in?
Piedmont Road. Piedmont Hospital's there in Atlanta, off Peachtree Street.
Okay, so that's a hospital there?
Yeah, Piedmont. Yeah, Kaiser Permanente is a hospital, and no, I do not like Kaiser Permanente. I wouldn't trust Kaiser Permanente doctors loose with my dog, much less with my dad, and that's who pretty much really. They didn't kill him because they had to allow us to give the stuff that was recommended out of the New England Medical Journal that was not available through the hospital for his heart condition. But we kept him alive for another year than he was supposed to live. He wasn't supposed to live when he went in 2000. But he did. We got him on the right stuff, and we got him out of there. Then my sister found this book about DHEA and taking too much of it being cancerous. Well, I had already explained that to him, that if you take the high dosages of DHEA, to trigger the human growth hormone in your body, taking too much can build up in your body and cause cancer. But he was only getting 5 and 10 milligrams of DHEA, with his L-carnitine and his coenzyme Q10. And that's what was recommended by the New England Medical Journal. And the doctors had to do it because it was listed as the proper treatment for his condition in that journal. That's like their Bible, they call it. So that's
right.
Once he got scared of the DHEA and he came off of it, that's when he went down and that's when we lost him.
Oh, boy. Sorry.
But, yeah, Carrier, Meneer, and all them trying to help my brother Nance get rid of me while he was dying in the ICU. And, of course, there are people turned on them, turned against them. They made a boo-boo. Two guys was working in this gas station there on Buford Highway, and I think it's Peachtree Shambliss Road or whatever is the intersection right there, and it's got the convenience store that has that extra retail space in it. Well, these guys was remodeling that on March 11th, 1997, when they were going to hit all those targets there in Doraville and Chamblee. And someone had placed a backpack of explosives there by the dumpster that was going to blow up the gas tanks and kill the people working there in that building. Well, they were working there. They hired them to monitor me at Piedmont Hospital while my dad was dying, after I escaped my brother's automobile the evening before on July the 7th, 2001. So they tell these guys, oh, he stole from this guy like $3,500, $4,000 worth of stuff, and he turned him over to the cops, and they busted him for drugs, so we need y'all to watch him. So when he leaves the hospital, we're hoping we can follow him back to the stuff that he stole from the guy and retrieve it to where we can get up the money to bond him out of jail. That's the lie that they have been told. Hmm. So regardless to say, they were not too happy two things. They found out they were working for the terrorists. And two, I was, number one, not a thief. Okay, number two, dang sure not an informant. And they're like, well, are you a federal agent? I'm like, fellas, please, no, I'm not even a federal agent. Well, what are you? I said, man, these doggone stupid SOBs made me the doggone top-appointed official of the state of North Carolina, and they were like, dude, what? So that was another reason they were mad. They were being tricked and trying to kill a government official.
Huh.
And so they weren't happy about that. So everybody from Buckhead in Atlanta, because these were the boys from Buckhead, to the boys up there in Topton, Robbinsville, and Andrews, everybody has vowed that if Roger Nance was to ever wind up with my mother's house, like I said he would do in 1999, and turn around and sue me for libel, because everybody knows he's involved. Everybody knows my brother.
Yeah, there's even you even got some voice recordings on some of them, too.
Well, yeah, like I said, I've had cooperation out of John, and John, he's pretty much admitted to everything exception to being out there at the Ramses when JonBenet was murdered, but I'm going to have a feeling he was there. He was not participating in her murder because there was a lot of people there who did not participate in her murder. But he's down there somewhere. I don't know, down there. I guess, but I'm on a conference call right now. Yeah, how much time do we have here?
We got about 34 minutes.
about 34 minutes.
Yeah.
Well, let's try to go ahead and run it down here for the next five. If anybody has any questions, they can ask right now, because I'm going to cut it short here. Up there at Amicalola Falls, they'll be down here in a little bit.
Who is?
Her niece.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he passed by. I left him a text. I was going to be on a meeting.
On the porch.
Okay. Well, I'll be down shortly. Yeah, I'm sitting over here. I'll be down shortly.
Okay.
Yeah, I pulled up over here at some friend's house. I would have better signal.
Oh,
but,
okay.
Yeah.
To check it on you.
Mm-hmm. But I think no call-ins yet.
No, there ain't no call-ins. No, sir.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people like you to just talk, and they'll say they like to hear, and so they'll listen to the other part. That's what
mm-hmm.
they told me. They said you get a lot done. If you don't be asked questions, you go through a lot of information is what I'm told. That's what they tell me.
Yeah, that's what I try to do. I like to talk to people on the level that I like to be talked to, where I don't have to ask them anything and sit there and be mm-hmm. able to answer the questions that they may wind up in their head, and they realize, well, he just answered that. I don't have to ask. It's something I've always tried to master since my childhood, because I started out in direct sales when I was only 9 years old, going door-to-door selling Watkins. And, you know, I always tell people, you know, if you ever want to love life, die a couple of times and come back, and you'll just about feel like, you know, really loving everyone and trying to, you know, help anyone you can and do anything you can to help them. But you have to lose your life a couple of times to get to this point. Or at least be put in a couple of dangerous situations, and because there's a lot of people that get to this point. There's nothing you can do to, you know, destroy their character. You might can destroy their reputation for a while, but eventually, Once that dies down and their reputation is restored, well, their character is their character. They're going to maintain being the, you know, individual that they've, you know, been all along, you know. And
right.
So if I have any negative stuff out of people, I've had some people tell me, well, you sound crazy. You're crazy. Well, at least I got every reason to be crazy. And shoot, I almost got killed first time when I was 9 years old, executed, you know.
Yeah, a lot of people don't want to believe a lot of this stuff that's going on. They need to open their eyes.
No.
That's why it's grown exponentially.
Well, yeah, because, you know, the scripture says, you know, evil rises when good men do nothing. And,
exactly.
You know, that hydrogen bomb over there at Cook Ridge. I really didn't want to have to do that, but what do you do when you got the son of gun that's already armed and set to go off? It's not like we could go over there and overpower a few guys and go down and snatch something that hadn't been, you know, set to go off. That wasn't the case, so what do you do?
Right.
You know, so here we are,
you
know, 25-year run.
Doing.
Yeah, I mean, but it's like I had to tell Governor Hunt, you know, that afternoon. I was like, we can take them down today, Governor. But what are we going to do when the copycats jump out?
Oh, yeah.
Because you got
so
friends
many
work over there
tonight.
U.S. Courthouse over there in Raleigh. They might go over there one day and they decide they're going to go hit that U.S. Courthouse anyway. You're going to take that chance. He really did not want to go to the rear parking lot of my office and negotiate with Matt McRae, the senior, to get that truck bomb out of Raleigh, because they intended to hit his building with a truck bomb on February the 2nd. the following week. So I really can't say I blame him for that. I would have been nervous going over there myself if I was the governor of North Carolina, knowing that, you know, these terrorists were going to kill me the following week. And there was around 120 FBI following this truck bomb in the Murphy, North Carolina, from over in eastern Tennessee. By 30 minutes. Yeah, they were 30 minutes behind McRae. So I don't know what would have happened if they had arrived before we got that truck bomb out of there. There was like over 200 spectators out there in front of all the businesses there. They couldn't do it there at the McDonald's because State Patrol had everything blocked off except for the drive-thru window of the McDonald's. The dining room was not accessed for public. Only the drive-thru was open that entire day. But all the businesses passed there. You had all these spectators. When they heard, they thought was Eric Rudolph that hit the New Women's Healthcare Clinic, because that's what he was being, you know, suspected for.
They thought he was trying to preserve and do something good instead of just trying to kill people.
Yeah. I mean, shoot, it's like I told people before, the way they described Eric Rudolph, shoot, I'd probably brought him in, sat down, and fed him myself and gave him a place to sleep. And, I'd probably bought him a case of Doritos. He could sit back on the sofa and watch TV while the feds were out there looking for him, if that were the case.
Exactly.
Because, I'm on the same page with a lot of people, you know. When a child is conceived and is in the womb, it's a human life. And you take away that human life, you've taken away that human life. It really is murder. So I don't agree with the murder of the preborn, but I'm sure as hell don't agree with the torture and the rapes and the murders of the little children who are born. There's nothing pro-life about people like Eric Rudolph. Nothing pro-life about them at all. Once everybody found out up there that was helping hide him out exactly what he was about, and that question that he asked me over there in the radio shack on my brother Bill's birthday in 1997 in January, I almost got him shot twice by his own mother.
Yeah, you can ask him again, but I remember that. I remember that question. Yes, that's pretty graphic.
That's the most horrific question I've ever been asked in my entire life. And so I can relate to why Beth and Matt didn't want to be a family under a government and system like this, that they would risk their lives to get her daddy busted and the rest of the bunch busted, than to have to live in a system that is governed by a bunch of doggone pedophiles. And Georgia is loaded with them. The state of Georgia is pretty much ran by them. And the ones who run the state of Georgia are the ones who controls what happens in Washington, D.C., behind the scenes. So it's not like we were not warned. We were warned by Eisenhower about the military-industrial complex, because even he feared that this huge thing would become a prison medical complex in addition to the military-industrial complex. So now we don't only that, but we got a child trafficking industrial complex called Child Protective Services.
Exactly.
So this whole thing is nothing but one huge, gigantic Ponzi scheme. Now we get to understand what their agenda was in the 90s, why they wanted to abolish the United States government. And that was to where they could put in their panels of judges and eliminate the jury system. So their panels of judges should determine if you're innocent or guilty of anything. And if you are, what they're going to sentence you to. And if you got anything to say about it, they can sentence you to death for that as well. So we're talking communism. And the most extreme... This is not something I heard out of some interview on television of two people talking or on some radio or some conversation out in the distance. This is the stuff that I heard horses' mouths themselves. We're going to do this. We are going to do that. But at least today we get to see that they wanted to do that to where they could have their little pedophile utopia. It does not matter what kind of government or judicial system that they have in intact, as long as they can get away with what the rest of the public cannot get away, and that is torturing, sexually abusing, and sacrificing children.
Right.
So some people will think, well, they won't hurt my children. They'll take me before my children. No. They'll murder you in front of your children. Then they'll have their fun with your children because you're not around to defend your children anymore.
Right.
So there's that fear factor
they
of a lot of people that...
Your kids go to school, they're not around you 24/7 on top of that, too, you know? I guess he had trouble, like his phone must have went out, his phone must have died or whatever. But I appreciate y'all for coming and listening. Thank you so much. Please support this channel. Please support him as well. It takes a lot of gumption to go to speak the truth with the things that happen in your life, and he actually is a witness, and he actually is telling the truth to his stories. He's got facts, he's got evidence behind what he says. Thank you, everyone, and God bless y'all.